to Denise Denton. She was a professor at University of Wisconsin from 1987 to 1996 in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and she is now Dean of the College of Engineering at the University of Washington. And today's date is November 20th, 2003. Perhaps you could start by telling me a little bit about your childhood and early years of schooling.
Sure. I was born in Texas and grew up in Houston. Went to public schools there from kindergarten through high school, and I was really interested in math and science as a kid, primarily in high school. My mother was a math teacher,
mm-hmm.
so I had a built-in role model with respect to mathematics, and I had a fairly clear picture in my mind at the time that I wanted to go to college, and I think I'm the first person in my family who ever went off to a four-year school. I had my uncle had gotten an engineering degree after going to a community college, and my mom picked up a bachelor's and eventually a master's in kind of bits and pieces of evening education and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody had ever just kind of gone off to school in the freshman year to a four-year university. So
okay. Now, were you interested in engineering when you were in high school?
Yeah, I was. I was in something called JETS, the Junior Engineering Technological Society,
mm-hmm.
and we would go to these science contests. I remember there was one at Texas A&M, and I was in the math club, and I took a program, a summer program at Rice University in the summer between my junior and senior year in high school,
mm-hmm.
and that was a program where we lived in the dorms at Rice and spent about a month there and met a lot of engineering faculty and grad students and did projects, and that kind of turned me on to the engineering.
Okay. So how did you get to MIT then?
Well, I had, done some homework about where I wanted to go to college. Our high school had a college night, and I went around to the different booths for all the different campuses, and I had read a lot that indicated that Boston was a really great college town,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to move far away from home and be independent. And so I really wanted to go to Boston. As I did more research, MIT looked like a great choice since I wanted to go into engineering.
Okay, and how were you able to finance your education?
Well, it was a combination of financial aid, support from my mom, and I worked while I was there. I got a scholarship after I got there, so it was kind of a mixed package.
Okay. And what led you to choose electrical engineering as your major?
I think a lot of it was that I had enjoyed the electrical engineering part of my Rice experience.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got to MIT, I started taking some EE classes fairly early on and enjoyed them. And I did some undergraduate research projects as a freshman that were very EE-oriented,
mm-hmm.
and so it kind of sealed the deal.
Were there very many female students in EE?
Not really. It was, I think at the time I was at MIT, it was about, let's say, 16% women, something like that.
Okay.
And there wouldn't be very many women in most of my classes in EE. I think women were more underrepresented in EE than in most other departments at MIT.
Did that bother you at all at the time?
Well, a little bit. I didn't really mind it that much. There were quite a few women in my dorm. I was in a co-ed dorm, so, you know, I had female peers,
mm-hmm.
in my living situation, and it worked out okay.
Okay. And how would you describe the atmosphere for women in science and engineering at MIT?
Well, I'd say it was mixed. I mean, there were certainly supportive faculty who were helpful. There was one particular guy, Arthur Smith, who was the head of the graduate program in EE, and he was extremely supportive.
Mm-hmm.
There were other faculty who were either neutral or slightly negative. So I would say it was kind of a mixed bag, but there was some good, you know, there was a women's room at MIT called,
mm-hmm.
the Cheney Room that had a lock on it, and it was explicitly just for women to go and hang out. So there were some things like that provided some solace or, you know, escape when it got too much to be in an all-male environment.
Were there very many female faculty members?
Not really. I don't recall ever having a female faculty member there until I was a grad student.
Really?
And as a grad student, well, I had, you know, I had a female faculty member in a couple of music classes, and I had one in a writing class, but in all of my technical and science-oriented courses, there was never a single woman professor. I had a female TA once. Even all the TAs were guys, you know.
Is there anybody there that you that served as a role model for you?
Yeah, well, Millie Dresselhaus, who is a physics and electrical engineering faculty member, she's a very famous person in her field and was the first woman to head the American Physical Society, and she's in both national academies, and I think she's gotten the Congressional Medal of Science. So I took a class from her in my first or second year as a grad student, and I got involved with a number of things she was doing around women in science and engineering at MIT. She was running a committee on women, and she asked me to join it, and so I got into some of those activities through
her. Okay, but that was only as a graduate student.
Yeah, and you know, I think as an undergrad I did a few things, but I got more into the whole thing as a grad student.
Okay, well maybe I should ask you then why you decided to pursue graduate education at MIT.
I had been in a co-op program, so I worked for 2 summers and then for a 6 or 8 month period out in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley. And I worked in integrated circuit design and manufacturing and did my master's thesis on a memory design project I was doing at Fairchild. And I really enjoyed the work in the company, but I found that it wasn't sufficiently satisfying, that's not what I wanted to do forever, you know. It was fun, but it was not complete. And I had been a TA as a grad student at MIT a couple of times, and I enjoyed teaching, and I'd always enjoyed teaching. I'd been a tutor when I was a kid, and so I really wanted to do something where I could have both the teaching piece and the research piece, and so I figured grad school was going to be a good way to move in that direction.
Okay, so at this point you were thinking of an academic career.
Somewhat, yeah. I wouldn't say I was 100% decided on that, but I was leaning that way.
Okay. Okay. And are there any other experiences from your graduate program that stand out? You mentioned that you were getting more involved in activities for women in science.
Yeah, well, I developed a course. At MIT, they have a January period called Independent Activities Period where there's no formal classes. And I developed a course for targeted for women on kind of introduction to electronics. And they would learn how to solder, and they would build small circuits that might do simple calculations or, you know, make funny noises or something like that, so that they would learn how to use equipment and become familiar with circuitry and fabrication of electronic systems so that they wouldn't be so intimidated. What I'd seen was that a lot of the guys coming to MIT had labs in their basement at home or something like that, but most of the women didn't have that experience. So I had a sense that a lot of women weren't choosing to go in these fields because they were kind of intimidated by the hardware. I wanted to give them some hands-on opportunities. So I taught that class 2 or 3 times.
Okay. Had you had any background in hardware before you came to MIT?
No.
Okay. And were you similarly intimidated at times?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a barrier to get over.
Okay. Now, can you talk a bit about your job search once you finished your PhD?
Well, so I went into went onto the job market. I interviewed at 7 schools, and I needed to go to a university that had a clean room, meaning a laboratory where integrated circuits are fabricated.
Okay.
Because that's a multi-million dollar facility. And you can't just build one as a junior faculty member. So, you know, I went around to these different 7 schools, and I think at every one of these schools I was going to be the first or only woman in their EE department.
Really?
At that time, that was 1986. And so there were a lot of gender issues, and I think I was asked illegal questions at all of the interviews, you know.
What types of illegal questions?
Things like, I mean, the main thing that would come up a lot would be, are you married? you know, do you have kids, that kind of thing.
Why do you think they asked you that?
Well, I think a lot of them, like there was one guy at the University of Minnesota who said, he was a much older guy, and he said, well, are you married? And I didn't answer because I knew that was an illegal question. And he instead of moving on, he said, well, you know, I mean, do you have a boyfriend? And I said, well, why is that relevant to this? Is that relevant to this position?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you know, if you have a boyfriend, then we're going to have to find him a job. And, you know, he was concerned about partner hire issues.
Okay.
And it's very unlikely that he would have asked a man.
Yes, yes.
So it was those kinds of things. And I remember at the University of Minnesota, the department chair was saying that they had apparently recently gone through a huge lawsuit about sex discrimination on salary.
Mm-hmm.
And the department chair asked me something like, well, would you be doing something like that? You know, would you be one of those people? Or I don't remember. It was kind of weird. But there was a lot of discomfort and just awkwardness, since these people weren't used to interviewing women or working with women peers. It was very, very awkward at a lot of the interviews.
Do you think there are some jobs you weren't offered because of your gender?
I think I got offers from almost all of these places.
Okay.
I think it took a lot of savvy to kind of navigate through what was going on and be a little bit forgiving about the fact that these people, you know, were probably trying to do their best, but really just didn't know how to handle the situation.
Okay.
And I think that there are probably women who would have gone through that process and somewhere along the way kind of blown up at them because they were doing some pretty stupid things. But I think I did end up getting offers from just about all the places that I talked to.
Okay, so they might have had concerns, but in the end they were able to realize that you were a qualified candidate.
Yeah, you know, I remember at the University of Minnesota, at the end of the day, after I'd been through the whole interview, or day and a half, and I'd given my talk, the department chair said, well, you know, we're really interested in you, and people are very impressed. And he said, you know, but they really have one major concern. And I said, well, what's that? And they said, well, they're just wondering what you would be able to teach, which was kind of an idiotic thing to say, you know? Why wouldn't I be able to teach what any guy who was interviewing?
Interesting.
They didn't feel like I'd be able to teach EE for some reason.
Huh.
So, you know, I kind of listed some of the things I would want to teach. And then I interviewed at Berkeley, and I had a similar experience there where there was a very famous guy, and I was in a little one-on-one with him. And at one point he said, well, I just don't understand what you'd be able to teach. And having been through this before, I was ready this time, and I said, well, I think pretty much anything in your catalog, you know? So you kind of had to deal with these things. They were just not prepared to interview a woman colleague.
Yeah.
One of the other things that happened at Berkeley was they were having a party. And usually you take somebody to dinner, you know, the candidate. And they said, well, you know, we're having this department party, so instead of taking you to dinner, we're going to take you to this party. And I said, okay, fine. So we go over to this guy's house, and it was a very senior faculty member at Berkeley in the EE department. And he was very hierarchical, so he hadn't invited any assistant professors, so there were no young people there.
Hmm.
And none of these guys wanted to talk to me, so I just kind of sat there all evening, you know, by myself, wishing I was somewhere else.
Yes, it sounds awkward.
Yeah.
Well, what were your initial impressions of UW?
I had a good interview there. It was, I think it was in March. I think it was extremely cold, like, you know, zero or something.
And you still came.
I wasn't used to that. And I had actually had surgery in early 86. I had thyroid cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see what the timing was here. Yeah, and then I was doing, I had the surgery in early 86. And it was a horrible major surgery, like 7-hour surgery under general anesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that Madison interview was one of the first interviews I did after my surgery, and I was really very tired. And, you know, it takes a long time to recover from something like that. And I also, because of the surgery, was very sensitive to cold because I didn't have my thyroid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty challenging to deal with that physical environment. in the health, you know, given my health.
Yes.
Worked out. It was kind of on the edge. But the people were nice. I had good experiences. I remember feeling good about the talk that I gave.
Mm-hmm.
The staff, there were no women in the department in terms of faculty, but women showed up, like women staff and maybe some women who taught general engineering stuff, you know, technical writing.
Okay.
And so that made me feel good that women had actually come out.
Yes.
To find their way there.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a lot of the places I interviewed, it was just men at the talks and things.
So what then made you decide to come to UW?
Well, you know, I was down to UW and Berkeley were my choices that I was really looking at, and I liked UW because I liked the people, I liked the area, I had never lived in the Midwest, you know, I'd spent a lot of time in California,
mm-hmm.
grew up in Texas, had been a long time on the East Coast, and I liked the idea of living in a new place, the lab seemed really nice, and I think that one of the things that kind of decided it for me was, of the seven schools, Berkeley was the only one that hadn't come out with an offer yet. They still were kind of messing around, and they'd call me up and ask, you know, can we have your transcripts from college, you know? And so I talked to my advisor about it, and we decided, well, I mean, it was just kind of weird. Nobody else had done that.
Yeah.
And so I sent them off my graduate transcripts, and then nothing happened. I didn't hear anything. And I was down to waiting for Berkeley, and Madison was the other choice. So Berkeley people called again, and the guy said, well, we're still trying to decide. Could you send us your undergrad transcripts? And at that point, I just thought, this is ridiculous, you know? And so I said to the guy, you know what? I'm going to Madison. I've made a decision. So the Berkeley people being such jerks kind of, you know, bumped me into Madison. I wasn't going to play that game anymore.
Yeah.
I could see the guy coming back and wanting my Head Start program reports on when I could recognize my primary colors.
Yes, I'm sure it's highly relevant.
Yeah, I didn't want to wait that long.
Okay, well, maybe we could move to your career then at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just like before when you arrived at UW, can you talk a little bit about what women were in the College of Engineering?
Yeah, when I got there, I want to say there were something like 180 to 200 professors.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other woman in the college that was in ME, Mechanical Engineering.
Okay.
And I went and sought her out, you know,
mm-hmm.
and she was pretty despondent and had not had a positive experience. And we tried to get together occasionally, but I think about 6 months after I got there, she left.
Okay.
And she went to become a faculty member at UT Austin
mm-hmm.
in mechanical engineering. She's still there. She's having a very good career. And from what I gathered, she had been treated pretty badly in ME at Madison. And
okay.
Once she left, I was the only woman at that point, and it was pretty... you know, again, awkward, just like the interview situation.
Certainly.
At these seven schools. These were a bunch of men who weren't used to working with women as colleagues, had no clue how to behave, were kind of asocial anyway, so, you know, it was a stretch.
Do you know anything about women who were in engineering before you arrived?
I don't, you know. I know there was one woman in EE prior to my arrival, at least one, that I know about. I don't recall her name.
Mm-hmm.
But she came and left before I got there.
Okay.
I think prior to the tenure decision, but I'm really not sure.
Okay.
And I have no clue if there were women in other departments before I came.
Okay.
I kind of doubt it, but...
Do you have any idea if at that point the college was making an effort to increase the number of women on its staff?
Well, you know, it didn't seem to me like there was any real concerted effort in place. I didn't get the sense that was a priority of the dean at the time. And,
okay.
If they were making an effort, they weren't doing very well, you know, because they had 180 people and one woman.
Yes, I guess so. Can you talk about your early years in the department and college and just
mm-hmm.
how you found the climate towards the women in the college?
Well, I think in the department, there were a few people that I immediately connected with, younger people.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy in particular that was, you know, a buddy, and we'd go to dinner with his wife and this and that. And he was a good colleague. A lot of the older people, I'd say kind of anybody over 45 or so, they were, a lot of them, unsure kind of how to interact with me.
Mm-hmm.
There, I remember, like, the first or second day I was there, I was at the mailboxes getting my mail, and one of the senior people came up, probably in their 60s, I don't know. And I introduced myself and put my hand out to shake his hand, and he wouldn't even shake my hand, and he kind of looked at me, looked up and down, and walked away. You know?
Really?
And I thought, well, gee, that's weird. And he walked over to his mailbox, and I looked at it, and I said, oh, okay, third. I didn't know who he was. And it was like third box over, fourth down, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and read the name off the box to kind of see who he was. But that was an extreme case.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was representative of the fact that most of them just didn't have a clue about how to interact with me.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it was me trying to decide how aggressive I was going to be about trying to build some relationships with these people, because it was going to be tough.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've talked about cases of rudeness, where there are people who were tried really hard to be nice, but somehow... I don't know.
There was some of that, you know. Like, I remember somewhere along the way, fairly early on, there was this really senior guy, and he was trying to be nice and trying to make an effort. And he asked if I would want to join his bowling league. You know? and I was hesitating, and he said, you know, we don't have any women. We'd really like to have a woman on the bowling league. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm already integrating engineering. I don't think I'm going to go integrate your bowling league. But it was, you know, he was trying to be nice.
Okay.
No
okay.
way would I want to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were a few things like that, yeah.
Okay. Did you find the climate considerably different than it was at MIT?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't as high pressure, wasn't as intense. People didn't work all hours. You know, nobody's going to be in the office on Christmas Day at Madison, at least not, you know, when I was there. And at MIT, you just had, people were much more fanatical
mm-hmm.
about their work. So in that sense, I think the Madison people had a healthier outlook on, you know, work-life balance. It's not that they were lazy or anything.
Mm-hmm.
They just were more reasonable about sharing time between work and family.
Okay.
You know, I think the big piece in this that I haven't mentioned is that one of the key people who was involved in recruiting me was Henry Guckel, who ran the clean room. You know, I talked before about
yes.
how I had to have clean room.
Yeah.
And he was the key faculty member in the department, as far as I can tell, who was kind of advocating for me and wanting to hire me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first couple of years there were, well, the first year, there were no other professors in that area that he was in of microelectronics.
Mm-hmm.
And at least not in the integrated circuit area. And so I was kind of the first one at that time, or the only other one at that time, who was explicitly going to be working with him in the clean room. And what started to become clear fairly early on was that his idea of how this was all going to work was real different from mine, in that he apparently wanted or was hoping to have like a super postdoc or a grad student type relationship with me.
Okay.
Where what I was looking to be was an independent faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part in some ways he thought that by hiring a woman, it would be easier for him to kind of manage that relationship and
yeah.
control my professional behavior.
Okay.
So that relationship began to get strained pretty early on.
Okay.
And it was a major issue almost from the beginning.
Okay.
I got a teaching award somewhere around the first or second semester that I was there. It was a thing that was run by the students, you know, and they
mm-hmm.
did their own voting and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he was quite jealous about the fact that I had won this thing, you know, just having arrived. And so there was a professional jealousy issue there,
mm-hmm.
and there was a issue of control.
Okay.
And it was a pretty complicated situation.
What ended up happening?
Well, ultimately, after I don't know exactly how long, but let's say a year to a year and a half, maybe two, I walked into the parking lot outside our building, and I saw this truck, Bill's Key Shop. It was a, you know, vendor from
mm-hmm.
the city. And I walked upstairs to where the lab is, and there was a guy in coveralls changing the locks to the clean room.
Oh.
And I said to him, well, what's going on? He said, well, I'm changing the locks. And I was very aware of the need to document. You know, I'd already kind of started kind of writing everything down, throwing
mm-hmm.
things into a shoebox. And I said, well, who asked you to do that? And he said, oh, well, Professor Guckel, you know. And so it turned out that Henry had changed the locks so that me and my students wouldn't be able to get into the clean room.
Oh.
Then this whole episode, you know, ensued that was very complex, and it involved, you know, people around the whole campus. So that was quite the scene.
In the end, you got back into the clean room?
Yeah.
Now, what mechanism, like, what did you do to try to resolve the situation? Because,
well, you know, initially, I talked, and I don't remember exactly what order all this happened in, but fairly early on, I spoke to one of my friends on the faculty, was another young woman from Texas who was in the law school.
Mm-hmm.
We'd never known each other before Madison, but her specialty was in race and gender discrimination law.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her what had happened. And she said, well, you know, Denise, he can't do that. And I said, well, Vicki, he did do that, you know, so mm-hmm. what's the next step? So she pulled together a number of senior women from the law school, I think one of whom had been on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, another of whom had argued the Johnson Controls case at the real Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
U.S. Supreme Court, and I brought along a colleague, Cora Merritt, who at the time was in our sociology department and went on to run one of the directorates at NSF later. And we all met at Vicki's house. It was a blizzard. I remember we had to push the one lady's car up the driveway through the snow and all this. And we all sat down, had a takeout dinner of Chinese, and I told them what was going on. And they kind of walked me through what I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what we decided to do was, I had gotten recently an annual review, you know, where the department chair sends you a letter saying, gee, this is how you did this year, blah, 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 your
mm-hmm.
teaching's fine, but you need to, you know, get more papers out or whatever. So they encouraged me to use that as an opportunity to write a letter in response in which I would lay out this whole scenario of mm-hmm. what had been happening to me and how I had been denied access to the clean room and then ultimately literally locked out.
Now, the chair of your department at this time, did he know anything about this?
Did he know I was doing the meetings and stuff?
Well, no. Was he aware of the situation between you and Guckel?
Was who aware?
The chair of your department.
Maybe I'd alluded a few things. I don't know. But what I did was so that was like on a Friday night, and they said, okay, and I told them I had this shoebox with stuff I'd been writing down, and they said, well, bring your shoebox tomorrow, we'll all have breakfast at my house, one of them said, and we'll go through the shoebox and tell you what to do, you know, which things matter, which things don't.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and had breakfast at one of their homes, and their husband cooked pancakes for us, and they went through all these things in the box, and they put them kind of in three piles. This doesn't matter at all, this matters a lot, and maybe this one's important, maybe not. And they said, okay, go out now and write the letter based on, you know, what we've told you is important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote like a 6 or 8 page double-spaced letter that day, went back by to my chair, went back by the same lady's house where we'd had the pancakes. She read it over, gave me some feedback. I took it on a disc to my younger friend, Vicki, and she read it over, made a few changes, and she said, look, Denise, you know, the one thing you don't have in here is the issue of sex discrimination. And I said, oh, Vicki, I don't know if it's really sex discrimination, blah, blah, blah. She said, look, you know, it goes in now, because if we ever end up in court, you can't, in the middle of the road, change your, you know, story.
Yeah.
So she counseled me that that really needed to be in there, and I said, okay, and so she wrote that paragraph. And that letter then went on to the department chair. I took it to him.
Okay.
And he read it, and he said, well, gee, you know, he wasn't surprised, and he said, well, you know, Denise, this guy happened to be Jewish, and he said, you know, Denise, I think he's anti-Semitic, too. And I said, look, Leon, you're really on your own for that one, you know? I mean, this is about me, right? And this was a pattern now that began to emerge. These guys had all been so terrorized by this guy, but they'd never had the guts to stand up to him or fight him.
Okay.
And so as we went through this thing, people would kind of come out of the woodwork, oh, well, he's mean to me, too, or he's always been mean to me, too, and,
yes.
you know, like that.
They
it was
wanted,
kind of interesting.
They
kind
wanted
of funny,
to join
but,
in.
They'd all been so timid, and I was, in essence, the first one that had had the guts to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting.
So what happened after you handed your chair this letter?
Well, you know, I think what I did, I I think the chair didn't really know what to do. He was scared of the guy. And I went along and saw the associate dean mm-hmm. for research and talked to him about it. And, you know, he had done research with Guckel and was kind of a colleague and didn't really want to rock the boat too much and said, well, you know, we could get you your own clean room. We'll get you a little one of those little clean rooms that you build, you know, and put it out in the parking lot or whatever. And I was like, I don't want a Keith Kit clean room. I want to be in the real big people clean room, you know. So he was trying to find some compromise that wouldn't directly confront Guckel. Well, I wasn't happy with that, and so then I went on up to the dean, and the dean basically spent, you know, half an hour, which is how long our meeting was, telling me about the new mast he'd gotten for his yacht and how long it was, you know, this really kind of phallic conversation. And when he did get around to the issue, he kind of said, well, look, Denise, you know, you've got great things going on, and you need to build your program, and Henry's got great things going on. He needs to build his program, and you shouldn't get in his way, and he shouldn't get in, you know. He was telling me, back off. You know, he wasn't going to do anything about it. So at that point, I was really discouraged because I'd run the chain of command as far as I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
As an assistant professor, you know, you don't know about provosts and presidents and stuff or who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and saw this woman. The only other senior woman in the college was a professional staff woman who ran the career services for the students, you know, the placement office. She's still there.
And what's her name?
And I went and saw her. And just kind of, you know, said, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm kind of at the end of my rope, and I've talked to all these people, and obviously nothing's going to happen. And she went to church with a guy who was at the time, like, the acting vice chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you need to go see this guy, you know. And I said, oh, well, why would I want to do that? Oh, well, he'll, you know, I know he's going to be supportive, and he'll help you figure out what to do.
And who was the acting?
So I gave this guy a call, and this was before Shalala arrived, so it was kind of between, you know, acting president type situation.
Would this have been Crawford Young?
No, this was Phil Certain.
Okay.
And so, you know, I called him, and it was like a Friday afternoon late, and he said, oh, yes, well, would you like to come right over? And I said, well, it's not that important. I mean, I think she had prepped him. I think she had said to him, you know, this is going on, and they had maybe colluded to have me call. And I said, you know, no, I can come on Monday. And once I went over there, then the ball started rolling, and he gave me a lot of good advice about what to do. And he recommended that I send a letter to both the associate dean and the dean. Or maybe it was taking that same other letter, you know, that I had written,
mm-hmm.
but putting it on, sending it on to the associate dean and the dean with a memo on top of it saying, look, I'm blind copying you on this letter that's gone to the department, but I need to get some support here with what's going on, and I'm also sending it over to, it was Certain and Bernie something was the acting chancellor.
Bernie Cohen?
Bernie Cohen, maybe.
Yes.
And I said in the letter, in the memo, I'm sending it over to them at their request as well.
Okay.
So then the ball started rolling and became big power politics, and the big guys got involved in kind of beating up on my dean and so on.
Okay. Now, at this point, are you still locked out of the lab?
Yeah. Or,
really? So you had several weeks in which you just couldn't do any research?
Quite a while, yeah.
Okay. And what was finally, how was it finally resolved?
Well, what finally happened was that my department chair set up a committee, the standard kind of academic remedy, when you don't have the guts to really do anything, you know. And the committee was members of my department, and they investigated the whole situation. They wrote up a big report. They interviewed a zillion people, including Guckel and myself and our students and so on. And they came up with a report that basically said, he shouldn't run the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And so the associate dean for research in the college kind of took that on, and they did take him out of running the lab.
Okay.
So, and then I got a key, and
did that mean that you were then in charge of the
lab? It worked out. It took some time. It took a cast of thousands.
Does that mean that you were then in charge of the lab, or was a
third? No.
Okay.
No, there was, for a while, they made the associate dean the, director of the lab. And they identified some money to go out and hire a staff person who would be the staff manager of the lab.
Okay.
And that guy's still there.
Oh, okay.
So there were a lot of changes.
And what did you learn from this whole battle?
Well, I learned a lot about academic institutions and how they work, where the points of leverage are, how the politics work, and, how one might effectively manage in an academic setting. So I think it gave me a huge jump start toward moving into leadership roles in, mm-hmm. in universities, because if you're in a situation like that and you're on the very bottom of the org chart and have no leverage, yet you have to kind of try to figure out how to make things happen,
mm-hmm.
it made it a lot easier as I began to get leadership roles. You know,
mm-hmm.
now as the dean, it's just so easy to do things yes. compared to what that was.
Yes.
So it was like a baptism by fire in academic leadership.
Well, it's 5 after the hour. My next question is about tenure. Do you think you have enough time to discuss tenure?
I've got another 8 minutes or so we can do a few more things.
Okay, sure. Well, do you want to just comment on your experience with tenure?
Yeah, so on my tenure process, when the whole key situation got resolved, somewhere along the way I was counseled to request a tenure clock extension
mm-hmm.
because of all of the time that I had lost with these battles.
Yes.
And I believe that I received a 2-year tenure clock extension.
Okay.
And then we got a new department chair, and, somewhere in my 4th or 5th year, I think it would have been a little bit early, I pushed that chair to put me up for tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And he really didn't want to, but I was pressing it. And one of the things that I was concerned about was that I felt like this group of people needed to vote no the first time. And I really didn't think that they were going to vote yes, no matter how strong my case was in round one.
Really?
And I just wanted to get on through that, and let them get it out of their system, vote no, and then let's come back and get the yes vote.
Why were you so sure?
So that's pretty much how it played out. They went through the process. They got outside letters. They did the whole drill. I think those outside letters were really, really strong from what I could ascertain.
Mm-hmm.
But, they voted no. And it was not catastrophic because, I had plenty of time with the tenure clock extension. And then when next year rolled around and they put me up again, I got a positive vote and everything, was hunky-dory. So
well, why were you so
sure?
The
process itself, I would say, worked out okay. I was disappointed that they couldn't wrap their brains around a supportive vote the first time around. One of the things I heard from one of my informants, who was a senior colleague, he said Denise, your letters are really good. You've got one letter from this woman, Millie Dresselhaus, who I mentioned to you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but that letter's not going to count because it's from a woman, so it won't matter. And that was a ridiculous thing to say for a lot of reasons, but one reason is that one woman, just all by herself, had more, honors and prestige and credentials and awards than the whole EE department rolled up in a ball, at Madison. But her letter wasn't going to matter because she was a woman.
If you could explain, why were you so sure that you would be denied the first time?
Oh, I just, this was just a group of people who wasn't ready, to vote yes on a woman, to accept a woman into their midst. And I think they just felt the need to kind of beat me down a little bit with that. And
to make you jump through a few extra hoops?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you think you were held to a higher standard than other candidates?
Oh, probably. Probably, yes.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure. Amy Wendt and Vicky Byer mentioned that you had been involved in work when somebody is unjustly denied tenure, and you were involved in changing the rules about what then happens. Did this relate to your own tenure
experience?
Okay,
well, there was this case with Seal Pillsbury. Hang on a sec. There was a woman at UW-Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
and I think she was in the business school there. And she'd been denied tenure, And by all appearances, she was better than three or four men in the same department who'd gotten tenure recently.
Mm-hmm.
And what we discovered was that the laws or whatever in the state of Washington were set up in, or sorry, Wisconsin, were set up in such a way that a department could vote no on a case, no, you know, deny tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this, there was a case at UW-Stout or someplace, I think it was Eau Claire actually, where a black guy had been denied tenure by his department, but the regents and or the chancellor had granted him tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the department members had sued or, you know, grieved through some processes, and they won. And the judge in court said, look, given the laws in the state of Wisconsin, I have to find for the members of this department, but fundamentally I have to tell you that I think these rules are out of sync with, you know, Title IX or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, equitable practices, because the bottom line was that the department could have basically said, we're voting against this guy because he's black.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the rules or the laws in Wisconsin were written, that couldn't be overturned.
Okay.
And so when a similar thing happened to Cecil Pillsbury, we mobilized around her case a number of women in the state, and we got an elected official, and I don't remember who it was, to push to get that law changed.
Okay.
And they called it the Pillsbury Law or something.
Okay.
And it actually got changed so that there could be some oversight in tenure denials in a way that made sense. And we all ended up going to the signing. The governor, Tommy Thompson at the time, came over to one of the, you know, that UW the administration building on campus there for the
yeah.
whole system.
Van Hyde,
but anyway,
yes.
It was up in the top floor of that tall building.
Yes.
And he had a big signing ceremony, and we were all there. And then we walked out, and we were waiting around in the elevator area to go downstairs. And he walked by. And it was all the women who'd kind of been involved in this, you know,
mm-hmm.
campaign. And he looked at us as he walked by and said, oh, well, if I knew all these beautiful women would be here, I'd have signed this law earlier.
Oh,
a real pig type person. So that was an interesting little thing.
Now, that meant that when a woman was denied, or a person was denied tenure, and it could be proved that it was unjust, what then happened?
You could now reverse it.
Okay.
Whereas before, apparently, it wasn't able to be reversed.
Okay.
By the people up on high.
Okay.
So, I don't know. You could find, you know, I'm sure that's in the records, that law change.
Okay. Okay, well, perhaps we should, actually, I'm going to just turn the tape recorder off.
Sure.